This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show.
Paul and Michael occasionally save the world.
Paul and Michael occasionally save the world.
Paul and Michael occasionally save the world. Occasionally.
Welcome, everybody, to a special edition of Paul and Michael Occasionally Save the World. With me tonight is a special guest, Rafer Roberts. We are here to talk about your new comic book, Grumble. Of course, people listening to this probably know you best from Valiant Comics, because that's pretty much where we started this whole podcast network, was Martin and I were doing the Valiant Central podcast, which you have been on a couple of times, once with us, once with a few other people. But welcome, Rafer. How are you doing tonight?
Doing great. It's good to be back. Whatever you're calling the podcast now.
It's a long name. I still don't know if we chose a long name to just to troll Martin and make him input it in all the databases and stuff or whatnot. But this podcast is Paul and Michael Occasionally Save the World. I started doing it with Michael, my buddy Sparky. He's going to be editing this episode. He didn't join us actually specifically because his internet is so unpredictable that he didn't want to potentially bog down the episode by his internet not working. He's from Texas. He's a farmer. Well, you know, what else can you say? But yeah, so on this podcast, our goal is basically to share things that we enjoy with each other and with whoever chooses to listen to us. So it is really a podcast all about positivity, not about the negativity. And you have a new comic. You were kind enough to share it with me, and I really enjoyed Grumble. So we're here to talk about Grumble a bit, and then, you know, whatever we feel like from that point. So, do you want to start us off a little bit? Tell us a little bit about Grumble and who you're working on it with.
Sure. Grumble is a comic that I'm writing. Mike Norton is illustrating. Marissa Louise is coloring, and Crank is lettering. It'll be coming out from Albatross, which is Eric Powell's company. And it's the story of a magic-using con artist, Deadbeat, who finds himself trapped in the body of a pug, and how he has to escape the forces of good and evil alongside his part-demon estranged daughter. So it's wild, madcap, borrows as much from Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Paper Moon, as it does from like Doctor Strange or heavy metal comics. It's a little bit of everything, and I think we found a pretty good balance, and I really like the comic a lot.
Nice. I enjoyed it a lot, too. Do you realize that you just totally spoiled your own comic, though?
Yeah.
I didn't know that it was his daughter. I mean, I assumed. Come on. It was pretty easy to assume from the first issue, but yeah, you didn't drop that bomb yet in the first issue.
Well, here's the other thing, is everybody in this comic is a criminal and a liar, so who knows?
Yeah, I love the vibe of the comic. I mean, you know, like you were saying, just the basics of the story is, you know, like when you first meet the guy, he just like it's, you know, con artist trying to con at a poker game or whatever game they're playing. So you know, kind of typical kind of thing. But man, my favorite part is I was enjoying it, but then when you get to that part where he turns into the pug, like it's not just that he turned into a pug, but just kind of how he turned into a pug and the fact he's like, I'm going to distract this guy. And he walks up to him like a person, but he's a pug. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Just the delivery of everything. Of course, Mike Norton doing the art, you kind of know that there's got to be a pug in there somewhere.
Yeah, the entire comic was born from an idea he had. So I don't want to take credit for the initial genesis of the comic. I'll take credit for what I've written and the comic that we've created, but the original genesis came from Mike, and his desire to do a Howard the Duck style comic, but with a pug who is an asshole, which is right up my alley. Like, yeah. Magic, talking animals. Everybody's a jerk and arguing with each other. This is great. And since you had brought up the Valiant stuff before, it really came from us working on Archer and Armstrong and just enjoying our collaborative process. And just I liked how he drew my scripts, and he liked the scripts that I was giving him. So I think we work really well together. I'm glad when he had the idea for Grumble that he came to me with it. Very, very grateful for that.
That's awesome. Yeah. You know, one of the first things I thought reading this too was, I haven't read you didn't have a lot of stuff really before you did the Valiant stuff other than the, your really indie stuff, which isn't the easiest to attain stuff. But I've read, you know, the work you did on Valiant between Archer and Armstrong, and Renegades. And I've read this. I also picked up the first couple of issues of Modern Fantasy, which we'll touch on a little bit in a minute too. So got, you know, kind of a cross section of what you've written a little bit there between the couple of Valiant things and this. And one of the things that stood out to me is this book, like, had a lot of similar feel to Archer and Armstrong, minus the being done with characters that kind of already had an established history. So you're starting with fresh characters, but there were, like, everything that was great about Archer and Armstrong, those kind of elements, like, even though the story and what's going on isn't at all the same, like, those elements of what made Archer and Armstrong good with your run are right present in this book. Like, obviously everybody loved Gub-Gub in your run of Archer and Armstrong. Now you're giving us
a bit of an overstatement, but I appreciate it.
I think I saw more Gub-Gub commissions than anything else from that book.
I'll say a lot of people liked Gub-Gub. but I've seen some detractors as well. It's like, as soon as Gub-Gub came in, I dropped the book. Or as soon as Gub-Gub came in, I kept buying it, but I didn't like it so much. He's like, all right, as long as you keep buying it.
Those were all the bitter old school Valiant fans. In our record of doing the Valiant Central podcast, we had these, like, kind of different movements. Like, our first phase was just us getting used to doing a podcast. And our second phase was a lot of us, like, constantly arguing with that old school mentality of fan that wanted nothing to be different. Then once we got out of that phase where those guys moved on and new people came in, then it was the phase of everybody, like, convincing everybody that the world wasn't ending because stuff was changing again. Because it's just like, you know, after a while, like, stuff has to change and be a little bit different. But that was kind of your phase with Archer and Armstrong, was we were getting the last trickles of those old school fans that didn't want to adapt to anything. And then getting the next wave of people that just wanted those core books that the, you know, company launched with to just continue on forever. And everybody's confused when they start ending at 25 issues or, you know, XO lasted to 50, but
one of the best bits of advice that Dinesh gave me early on was to not worry about stuff like that. That there's always going to be a fan when you take over a book who's going to hate you no matter what you do, because you're not the creative, you're not the writer who they fell in love with. Like, when I took over Archer and Armstrong, I heard a lot of "Wish we could get Fred back." When Fred started writing it, he heard a lot of, well, Barry Windsor Smith wouldn't have done it this way. But, like, as it evolves, you're eventually going to be somebody who, if you do your job correctly and write a good book, that the book will stay solid and people will find that they liked it more down the road once they get past that initial shock of not being who they want to write the book, so to speak. So,
yeah,
there's one of the coolest things that Dinesh told me early on, and really, I didn't get a lot of flack or talk, but there was enough as a young creator that were a creator just getting into the more mainstream superhero stuff, that it probably were the kick my ass a lot more if I didn't know that Dinesh and Warren and everybody at Valiant had my back. So.
Yeah, Dinesh and Warren were the best. When we had our 100th episode, they actually came on along with a few other people from the, I guess you'd say, like, front office of Valiant. They talked with us for 4 freaking hours on our 100th episode. It was ridiculous. I was drunk by the end of it. People actually PayPal'd me money to get me alcohol to drink during that. And I was like, all right, they send me money, I'm going to buy it. It didn't take that much to get me drunk because I'm not much of a drinker. But yeah, it was touchy-feely by the end after a six-pack of apple cider. It's interesting from my perspective, too, seeing, like, what you experienced coming in, you know, and then comparing it to what Fred experienced. Because I came in as a Valiant fan with the relaunch. I never read anything back in the 90s. I hated comics as a kid. Didn't like them at all. So, I mean, I never even knew Valiant existed. So my first taste of it was Fred Van Lente, and that was actually the first comic I got was Archer and Armstrong. And then eventually I started going back to the old stuff because there was just there were only so many Valiant books coming out, but there was all this old stuff. And the Archer and Armstrong from the old series was what I thought was the best. I loved what Barry Windsor Smith did, but you can see there's a difference between these two things, but they're both good things.
Yeah. And I'll agree with you. The early Harbinger stuff is pretty good, but as far as how well it holds up to modern scrutiny, I'd say the Barry Windsor Smith, Archer and Armstrong does the best job.
Yeah.
It seems the most timeless.
Yeah, I think so, too. I have some issues with that first run of Harbinger, some of the things that they did. It just really doesn't stand the test of time. It looks pretty awkward today, in my opinion. But, you know, that's just my opinion, too. Don't need to get back on that horse. But
yeah.
Let's get back to you anyways.
Positivity.
Yeah, exactly. It's the positive. I don't need to talk about how much I didn't like Rexo in that first run. So Modern Fantasy, let's get to that a little bit. I actually have Sparky sent me some questions here. He loved... Sure. Modern Fantasy. So his first question with Modern Fantasy, well, first of all, I guess, why don't you tell us what Modern Fantasy is and who you worked on that book with?
Sure. Modern Fantasy is the book that I'm doing with Kristen Goodsnuck of Hench Girl and Making Friends fame. It's basically the modern world if our entire history was Dungeons and Dragons modules, fantasy novels, and Lord of the Rings. So it's like modern Brooklyn, but orcs for going on Tinder dates with goblins. Our main character, Sage of the Riverlands, is a ranger who's come to the big city looking for adventure, but instead finds nothing but data entry temp jobs and small, dirty apartments with two other roommates. So it's taking the fantasy tropes and putting them with modern-day situations. Hence the title Modern Fantasy, which... which was actually just a placeholder title for the longest time. It's like, we couldn't think of anything better. I was like, all right, here we go. This is what it's called now. I think even the contract we had with Dark Horse was to publish this comic series tentatively titled Modern Fantasy. But I think it works, and it's fun to say.
Yeah, it's definitely a good name. I love Dark Horse, I think, has become my favorite publisher just from the kind of breadth of stuff that they do. So this has got me kind of into a different little nook of Dark Horse that I hadn't read because I've been more like Hellboy stuff or like Lone Wolf and Cub and you know, quite a few different things, but a little more on the horror-ish side. I never grew up with D&D or anything like that. I've played it once. My wife and I had roommates back when we lived in California where it's too expensive to not have roommates. That were into, one of them was into D&D, so we all bought dice and we played one time, and that was it. So I've had one experience playing a D&D game, and it was kind of like, let's just do this little game to kind of give it a taste. But Sparky loves it. He grew up with that stuff, so he was super excited about it. His first question is, what's your D&D background? What did you like to play? Where did you get the idea to bring that into the book?
My D&D background, all throughout high school and a little bit into college, we were playing second edition. I played, this is going to show off my, crossover nerd appeal. My character was based on Cerebus the Aardvark.
So, you're pulling me in more now.
Yeah, there was like an early issue or a reprint where somebody had like rolled up the stats or said what the stats would be, and I had friends who were already playing together, and I wanted to play, so I'm like, all right, let me just play this. So I played it in character as Cerebus. He got his ass kicked so much early on because those stats were weak. So they ended up taking pity and like gave me like a whole bunch of really cool weapons, at least. But yeah, we'd play down my friend Scott Patterson's basement, which is also where I got the idea for the going inside the bag for Archer and Armstrong, came from these D&D sessions. But yeah, we'd play, usually have between, like 4 to 8 players at any given time, making Scott's life absolutely miserable. I cannot remember a single session that did not end in a fight, somebody getting punched, or people just storming out, like breaking, like smashing plates happened a lot. I grew up in New Jersey, so I don't know if that helps explain the violence that our game sessions were going through. And we were still good friends. Like, we'd get in fights, and then we'd still show back up the following weekend to play some more. So, I don't know. What do we know?
Our friend Aaron, who lives in New Jersey, he's talked quite a bit about selling you books that you wanted to find that were source material for this.
Yes. Yeah. He sold me a bunch of monster manuals. I think I got a Tome of Magic from him as well. It was good. I don't know how much I stole literally from the books, but at least reading through them helped to jog my memory of what I remembered and helped fill in some gaps. And I think if there was a few monsters and stuff that I took, a lot of stuff I just made up. So I figured, like, well, this is their history. This is now however many thousands of years later, so I'm going to evolve this into something that works for this world. But yeah, those books were a great help. So thanks, Aaron.
Sparky's last question, I think everything else kind of merged together, is he wants to know if this is an ongoing series or a mini-series.
For Grumble or Modern Fantasy?
Modern Fantasy.
Modern Fantasy is 4 issues. We're hopeful that sales are good enough to warrant more later on. It'll probably be months before we know, for sure. Kristen's busy working on a sequel to her Scholastic book right now, so I need to talk to her and see actually what her schedule is and how soon she'd even be able to start drawing one. But we both absolutely want to do more. I've got ideas for at least 2 more miniseries. The next one would focus more on Gondra, Sage's dwarven roommate, and some of her family issues. We get to see more with Bakhtar, and I realize now as I'm talking that the 4th issue of Modern Fantasy hasn't come out yet, and I don't want to ruin anything. So, no, they all die. They all die in the end of issue 4. It's horrible.
I think Gondra was my favorite character, too, by the way.
They're all so much fun to write. Working with Kristen is great because there's so much personality in her drawings that I can really just picture what they're going to be doing, just really what the page is going to look like. And I feed back off of her drawings, and it's just real good. It's a blast to write, and I'd like to write a lot more. So hope that trade paperback sells.
Awesome. So back to Grumble, since we kind of diverged off of that a little bit. So what's the plan with Grumble?
Grumble is ongoing. I think if you look at the solicitation, it says 1 of 5, but there was a little bit of confusion there. It's ongoing. It's ongoing for as long as we're not hemorrhaging money, like every other comic out there that's announced as an ongoing. everything's an ongoing until it loses money. And then it's a limited series. That's the secret. That's the biggest secret in comics.
I think anybody who's bought Image Comics has figured that out by now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I've got... I'm outlining issue 5 at the moment. And I've got the next 2 story arcs pretty well figured out. And then after that... we could go forever. I know Mike's having a blast. I'm having a blast. It's just way too much fun for us to stop. And it basically has taken over my entire brain. It's like my brain now, like my thoughts are 40 to 60% constantly thinking about Grumble and things I want to do and picturing what Mike's going to do with it. So when I just sort of trail off in normal conversation and stop talking, it's because I just got like another story idea, or I was thinking about something awesome that Mike and Marissa and Crank have done already, and I just can't stop thinking about it.
That's awesome. I was really excited about this book, too. Mike Norton, I've always had kind of a fondness for him. And the reason is, I mean, obviously he does good work. The first work that I checked out of his was Revival on Image, and him and Tim Seeley. So the reason I checked that out in the first place was the first Comic-Con I ever went to, and I've only been to two, which is kind of lame that I've been able to go to more, but I live in Maine, so, you know, I'm limited. I didn't know anybody. I had just gotten into comics, so I didn't know writers, artists, anything. So my comic shop in Portland, Maine was putting on the con, and the first people that he announced for the con was Tim Seeley and Mike Norton being there for Revival. So I started getting Revival just because of that. Didn't know anybody else. Like, this is how little I knew is, Lee Weeks was there. I didn't know who Lee Weeks was. That's how little I knew about comics. He's awesome. Yeah. Like, I've never talked to him person to person, but like, after I missed out on meeting him and getting to see him at the convention, I heard all this stuff about him. That guy was there. Like, he was literally like the next table to J.K. Woodward, who I got to know at the convention. But nobody pointed me over to Lee Weeks, so I had no clue. But that's how little I knew about comics at the time. I didn't know who anybody was. But I got to know Revival.
Every time I've run into Lee, he's been super friendly. He also draws the best Hulk feet in the business. Nobody draws the Hulk's feet better than Lee Weeks.
That's good to know. I'll have to go check out his Hulk feet out.
Yeah, because it looks like there's weight. The way he draws, it makes it look... It makes the Hulk look solid, like he's standing on solid ground. It's a very subtle detail, but I'd like it a lot.
That's awesome. But yeah, that's how it was for me. So I checked out who they were. I read their book, and I went by their table once, and I bought a print from them. And then one of the vendors had a package of like the first 10 issues of Revival. So I got that. I just wanted to get one signed, but I went over there and Mike was gone from his table the last day, and he was gone. I just kept on going by and he was gone. It turns out that he was super hungover and was like hiding under his table most of the day. So then at the end of the show,
it's a big table.
Yeah. They were pretty big tables. But at the end of the show, I was hanging out with J.K. Woodward, because my friend and I that went got to know J.K. And I told him, like, oh, yeah, I wanted to get Mike and Tim to sign these, but I missed out on it. No big deal. Well, then they show up because we're at, like, the hotel bar. And J.K. goes, like, hey, Tim, sign these. He gives them the whole stack of 10 comics, and Tim signs them all. And then Mike Norton comes out, clearly still hungover. And he gives them to Mike Norton. Mike Norton just grabs them and signs them all. So that was my first impression of Mike Norton, was just, you know, really awesome guy. Like, I loved his work in Revival. And then he was super awesome, like, even, you know, dealing with a hangover, being, you know, that congenial to a fan and all that. So I was excited about this because I already knew you, obviously. So anytime a couple of people that I am fond of get together, it's going to be something good. And I really do enjoy this book. So I'll be subscribing to this for sure. And hopefully keep the numbers up so you can keep on making it.
Yeah, it's going to be super fun, super weird. And the thing about Grumble and really any of my, like the creator-owned books that I work on, and the freedom that it gives, I try not to... It would be easy to phone it in, to just be like, all right, well, this is good. I'm just going to sit down and crank out a script. But basically every script that I'm writing for this, I'm trying to both push myself and just try to make it the best comic that I possibly can, to the point of where it drives me crazy sometimes. Like, what's the word I need? Or I rewrite the same sentence like four times just trying to get it spot on. And some of the stuff that in the script I've been asking Mike to do has been above and beyond. And he's been absolutely kicking ass on everything. Like, I feel bad. Issue two, there's... they go to the giant farmer's market area of Baltimore. And I'd like the way Mike draws crowds, but I always feel bad about asking him. So I'm like, you can hide stuff behind here if you want. Don't worry about showing all this. And he turns a page in, and it's just this, like, overviews, like 20 tents, and like 200 shoppers. And each tent is selling something unique. I'm looking, I'm like, holy crap. Like, this is gorgeous. I feel bad. And like Michael grumbled a little bit. And he's like, yeah, no, this is what we do. It's amazing. I I feel like the luckiest man in the world being able to work on this book with such talented artists. Like every single person involved in this book. I keep thinking I'm going to get pinched and wake up.
But it really shows, too. Like, it took me a while to really, like I said, it's only been, five or six or seven years ago that I really got into comics. So it took me a while just to understand creators' names, like writers and artists. My first aha moment with the writer was Matt Kent when he was writing a couple of books for Valiant. I realized I liked both those books. I was like, Matt Kent writes both of these. Maybe I should see what else he writes. And then artist took me a while. But colorists, like I've been focusing in more on that lately. There were a couple of guys for Valiant that, early on, because they basically did, David Barron and Brian Reber. I almost can never remember both of their names at the same time. Usually I get one and I forget the other one. But I got both of them, so I'm proud of myself right now. But then, Matt Hollingsworth, I started realizing, different books that had no correlation, and I really liked them separately, and then I just clicked that he did the colors for them. And Marissa doing the colors on this book, her color work is fantastic, and it definitely does a big part of setting the mood in it.
Yeah, and I like working with everybody, and everybody has the same goal of let's try to push this a little bit further. What I like most about Marissa's coloring isn't so much the colors themselves, even though they're absolutely gorgeous, but just her willingness to try new things. Be like, I'm going to try something weird here. I don't know if it's going to work, but let's try it. And 99 times out of 100, it's going to be the most incredible thing you've ever seen. So it's like there have been pages that pop, that come through. And you read the colored PDF, when they first are in that weird, extra dimensional space, and there's that dodecahedron spaceship, and it's like the weird pop in colors. When I first got that, I was like, oh my god, my eyes are melting. This is beautiful.
Yeah, she really did a fantastic job on it. So I was trying to scroll through Twitter while you were talking, and I'm always terrible at remembering names, but you mentioned your letterer for this book. You could teach me a little bit here.
Crank.
Okay.
Crank
so
with an exclamation point.
So that's kind of my next layer of developing my knowledge as a smart comic fan, where, I'm trying to get the details in it. So tell me, you've already said that everybody involved has added a lot to this book. Tell me a little bit about the layer that lettering added on to this book.
I didn't know Crank before we started working on Grumble. He's lettered a bunch of Mike stuff in the past, and Mike trusted him, so we brought him in. But he's been a pleasure. There's not been, a lot of times where when you go through a lettering pass, you'll have to be like, well, you should move that balloon over here, or put this in a different position, kind of guiding the letter. But Crank's been amazing. I haven't had to do any of that sort of nitpicking on his lettering. Most of this stuff has been me making his life a living hell. Like I say, rewriting a sentence two or three times. I try not to do that when we get that involved into the lettering, but sometimes it happens. And he's been very gracious about those sorts of things as well. It's what I hearken it to. I want to try to describe this for people who have a day job. So just imagine if you're going to your day job and there's only five other people at your job, and they're the most amazing people to work with. And you enjoy going into work to the point where you would willingly go in to work your day job for free if it came down to it, because you enjoy it so much. That's basically how I'm feeling on Grumble right now. So hopefully that joy carries through on the page. I really hope so.
I think it does. I think you can really tell when people really love what they're doing. I've read a lot of different stuff by this point, and I've always dabbled a lot in a lot of the independent stuff. And if you look through all the different podcasts we have on the network, first of all, it's crazy that we developed this podcast network out of a bunch of people that basically listened to the Valiant Central podcast, and then we got them doing their own podcast. But we have guys that focus on indie books and stay away from the big two books. We got guys who focus on the big two books from both companies. Just all sorts of different stuff, all sorts of different influences. So I always, kind of check out the different things that anybody's interested in. And seeing the way different creators do in different scenarios. Like, some creators, I feel like, do their best stuff with the big two, and their independent stuff is a little too unbound. Some people do best without those boundaries, and, you know, if they have more boundaries, you could tell that they're doing it within the lines and that there's a difference to it. But when you get the people that are doing, like, the thing that they want to do the most at that time, that, you know, just like you're talking about how much you love Grumble and how it's just, like, running on, you know, on all cylinders, you could really see the difference in that book. And that stood out to me really big time with Grumble. I can't afford to buy many comics right now. Like, I'm in a tight spot financially. So I'm only getting a few comics a month. So, like, I read Grumble and right away I was like, this is going to be one of the books that I'm getting, which, like, for me right now is saying a good amount. You're going to be one of, like, maybe four or five books I'm getting for, you know, for Grumble. So
that's very nice.
Yeah, you cracked my top four.
You buy 100 books. I'm glad we're in your short list. I'm about the same way. Mine's more of a time thing.
Yeah.
I don't have a lot of money either, but it's more of I don't have time to read 30 comics a week.
Yeah.
So I've got, like, my five that I will 100% read whenever they come out every month. But
yeah, that's fortunately I have both factors, so it makes it hurt less to have one factor or the other. Yeah. You know, I got a day job, and then, you know, my family's fairly time consuming right now. My son's still a little guy, so my time's pretty much taken up by everybody. It's you pare it down to the few books that mean the most to you and that you get the most out of. One thing that's great is there's so many easy ways to attain books nowadays. So it makes it easier to try things out without taking a financial risk or not knowing if you want to commit all the time. Comixology is great. That's how I checked out, Modern Fantasy, because I almost asked you if you had any, preview PDFs I could get of it. I was like, I'll just go buy it at Comixology. It's right there. It's so easy, you know? It makes it easy to check out different things. So, yeah, I have no idea how much you get out of that, but you got a couple bucks from me, probably.
I'll find out when they do the accounting, I guess. That's where they'll send me the check, like, but where's that digital sale? Where's the digital sale? I don't see it on the invoice.
So on that note, what comics do float your boat? So let me ask you two questions. You can answer them however you feel like it, but, you know, what nowadays are drawing your attention, and what got you into comics? What were your favorite things when you were first, getting drawn in?
Well, right now, like I said, I'm not reading too much modern wise. Stray Bullets always makes the top of my list. It's basically the best, I'm concerned, the best comic out there. Every issue is amazing. And we just started, my friend and I have just started doing a reread, her for the first time, me for about the 30th. And it's amazing how well those early issues still hold up and kind of blow your mind, and especially now seeing how that connects with the issues that are coming out now. It's just amazing and inspirational.
Is that David Lapham?
Yes. Yep. So bring it back to the Valiant stuff.
I actually have some of that digitally, thanks to I think it was an Image Humble Bundle that I got an array of stuff, so I'll have to check that out. I think I have it on my Kindle at the moment.
Yeah. Reading it the first time, I would treat it as if you're watching Breaking Bad for the first time. You'll have a inclination to want to binge. I would avoid it for your own mental health. I'm still keeping up with Walking Dead. Still liking that. I'm going to pronounce the title wrong, probably Isola. That's been coming out from Image. It's been gorgeous and really well written. I've got like a million friends with books coming out and who have books out. I'm reading them all. All of my friends, I'm reading all of your books. I've also been going back and reading a lot of my old stuff, like digging like all the 70s and early 80s Marvel and DC out of my collection and rereading it. Mostly because I'm trying to pare down my collection. So he was like, yeah, I'm going to read this one more time before I sell it kind of stuff. But a lot of times it's like, I'm going to read this one more time before I sell it. And then I'm like, I'm not selling this. I'm keeping this. This is awesome.
Wait, when did you start reading comics? What era was it?
It was early 80s. I always go to ROM Space Knight Annual number 2 was probably the first comic I ever bought and read. I think that came out in like 82 or 83. It's the one that's got the Bill Sienkiewicz cover.
I love his work.
Yeah, so I was a Bill Sienkiewicz fan since day one. And then I stuck with Marvel. It was mostly, I think I was like 5 or 6 at the time. So it's really been in my blood since early childhood. There was a period of time when I went to college, I didn't really have a comic store. So from 94 till about 98 or 99, there's like a dead spot of my comics knowledge. But I never really stopped reading. I just stopped having good access to comics, so I fell off the wagon for a little while. But
yeah, there was kind of something about those days, though, when it was harder to get stuff. You kind of appreciated it more.
Yeah, I mean, I was still able to get a few of the indie books that I had been reading. Like the Evan Dorkin stuff that was coming out at the time. But as far as like the mainstream X-Men stuff, I can't figure out what's going on in X-Men because of those missing 6 years of my knowledge 20 years ago. It's like, why is this happening? Like, oh, this happened during this time. Like, I don't remember that at all.
Nobody ever knows what the hell's going on in X-Men, though. That's just part of it.
Yeah. Oh, I read the Multiple Man series that just recently came out. That was pretty good. I like that.
I read the first issue of that. It was a fun read. I haven't checked out more of it yet, but I probably will down the road a little bit. As I mentioned, I didn't get into comics until it was when I moved to Maine. I'm from California. My wife met me out there and then hauled me back to Maine because, you know, we wanted to live somewhere where we could actually afford to live. And when I moved out here, that's when I started reading comics. I had dabbled in a little bit before that, but I really got into comics. It was like right after New 52. Because it was close enough that I was able to go back and get all the Batman that had come out in New 52 so far. But X-Men was kind of the next thing I got into. But I grew up, I was born in 83, so like, you know, I was kind of really growing up in the 90s, and comics just didn't appeal to me at that time. They looked too chaotic to read. I'd rather just read a book. And I finally have gone back to, I've always had a hard time reading older comics because the style is just so different from nowadays where the art drives a lot more of the story and you don't need as much writing. So going back and reading the older stuff was always hard. And I picked up some Marvel Essential Collections of the X-Men, starting with Giant Size, then going on to, you know, Chris Claremont's run. And that was really what finally broke me into being able to read older comics and appreciate them. So X-Men's kind of become my big thing. I always liked them anyways because, of course, I grew up in the 90s with the X-Men cartoon on TV.
Right.
So
that's a good starting point then, because that basically took from the Claremont era. So That's good cross promotion.
Yeah, I think it's kind of helped with getting back in. I mean, Giant Size introduces some of my favorite characters, and then Chris Claremont just does so much to develop them. So that was what got me kind of broken into being able to read that. And then I've been slowly moving my way around. So I'm always interested to kind of hear what people were reading back then. You know, any of I guess any comics are coming out. I'm always a little more drawn to the indie stuff. I'm a big Ninja Turtle fan. I don't know if you recall, but you drew me a Bebop and Rocksteady commission. That's one of my favorite things.
Oh, right. Yeah. I remember the drawing. I have trouble remembering who I draw stuff for.
Oh, I'm sure you do so much. I certainly wouldn't expect you to remember that.
But no, I remember that drawing. I like that one a lot. That one turned out really well.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
Cover, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That was, I only have a handful of commissions on my wall, and they're more Ninja Turtles than not, but I also had talked to you about, and someday I'll actually be able to afford to pull the trigger on it, but I want to have you do the baby Hellboy and the pancakes for me.
On a sketch cover? That shouldn't cost too much.
No, your rates are ridiculously affordable. Anybody listening, if you want a commission done and he has time, get a commission from Rafer, because you, sir, are affordable, and you do a fantastic job.
Yeah, my problem is I don't do them very often, so you got to get me at a show. Because if you try to get me to do it while I'm at home, I will always find something else to do. That's my problem.
I managed to slip that Bebop and Rocksteady in at least, but that's my problem, is I don't get too many shows in Maine, and usually any shows we get around here, there's nobody that I actually care about seeing. I was
a good time. I think I was taking a bunch of commissions around then.
Yeah, I was probably kind of lucky. It was right around when you were starting at Valiant, so probably, I don't know, I guess hadn't gotten rolling too hard yet. Yeah, I'll beg you for that Hellboy one of these days.
Yeah, no, that would be fun.
Yeah, see, I think that's part of the reason I probably talk you into stuff too, is I know which things to ask for that it'd actually be fun to do. Not just do this thing that everybody else asks you to do.
All right, I'm going to get your opinion. I've been asked to do a commission of either. It's really cool. The guy's got these sheets of paper that are that fit into Blu-ray the sleeves on the Blu-ray case.
Oh yeah.
So he gets artists to do fake covers, like just original art for the covers for it. So my choices for this are between Gremlins or John Carpenter's The Thing. Which do you think I should draw? I start leaning towards The Thing, and then I'm like, oh, but I really want to draw some Gremlins. And I start doing the Gremlins, and I start thinking, nah, my style would be way better for The Thing. So I don't know. I might just end up drawing both, and then seeing which one he likes more, and then holding the other one hostage.
So here's my take on it. And I'm looking up images of The Thing right now because I have never seen that, but I vaguely knew what it was. Even though your style may naturally fit The Thing more, I would say go Gremlins, because the best commissions, in my opinion, are the ones that take something out of its style to some extent. And you'd be awesome at the Gremlins. Like, you're great with anything that's kind of creature-ish and kind of quirky and different, too. And you can do so many different things with the Gremlins. Is it the Gremlins or the Gremlins 2? Like, which movie is he having you do it for?
Gremlins 1, so I won't be able to do the girl Gremlin.
Ah, the best one is the vegetable Gremlin.
Spike, like, murdering Mowgli. Gizmo.
I'm going to go Gremlins.
He's a Mogwai. His name is Gizmo. I know these things. I've seen
the movie. Yeah, Mowgli is the kid from the Jungle Book.
Yep. Mogwai. This is what happens when we record at 10:30 at night.
I really want to get you to do a They Live commission now, though.
Oh, that would be good.
So I was asking a friend of mine to borrow that movie, and they were telling me how it's their favorite John Carpenter movie. I saw that movie as a kid for one reason. It wasn't John Carpenter. It was because Roddy Piper was in it.
I hated that movie when I was growing up. It's like, I liked it, and then it's like, what is this 45-minute frickin' fight scene in the middle of this alley? What am I watching? And
I then just
like 15 minutes of movie after that. I'm like, what the hell was that?
Oh, it was an awful scene. I just watched it again. I watched that movie when I was a kid once. I was way too young to see a rated R movie, but I was a huge wrestling fan, so my dad rented it because Rowdy Piper was in it. We watched it. I remember being very just, like, shooken up by seeing boobs at the end because I was too young to see boobs yet. And, you know, let alone the F word is used heavily in that. But that was the last time I saw it, and then I just borrowed it from somebody and watched it. Yeah. And I was like, this movie is awful. But so many parts of it were, like, so great, even though it was awful. But then you get to that fight scene, and it's just, oh, my God. It's like, okay, a wrestler is the actor in the movie, so they have to have this massive fight scene that just has no point to it.
Yeah. Besides, we all know what the best John Carpenter movie is. I'm going to say it. It's Escape. Well, Let's Escape from New York. No, it's Big Trouble in Little China. Big Trouble in Little China is the best.
Those are both very good movies.
Yeah, I think it's Escape from New York, because I said it first, like, do I think that's the best?
I think internally you think it's the best.
That's very Freudian. Big Trouble in Little China.
See, intellectually, you know that you should say it's Big Trouble in Little China, but in your heart, it's Escape from New York.
It's Escape from New York.
Just like with the commission, in your heart, you want to do Gremlins, but in your head, you're thinking The Thing. So
it's the exact same thing. It's exactly the same. I'm learning so much. You should change this podcast to cartoonist therapy. It's like a therapy session where creators come on and learn something about themselves.
That's fantastic. So, Martin, who did the VCP podcast with me, he does many other things, but he's doing, Comic Talk Today, which he's been killing it at that. And he does Therapy Thursday. So every Thursday he has an episode where he has somebody on and is, conducting this type of therapy. So I had no intentions of being therapy for you, but apparently I am naturally, keeping pace with Martin there. Maybe he and I think that's a little bit too much alike.
Yeah, I had a carpenter epiphany. That's pretty good.
let's hit a couple of Twitter questions and then see wherever this takes us after that. I will say before we get to these Twitter questions, so I asked you a few questions off the podcast to get my mental juices flowing in case we had time to ramble on to other stuff. So I was listening to a bunch of They Might Be Giants because when you said all the different shows you've seen this year, They Might Be Giants is a band that I've grown up just always liking. So I was listening to them a bit. So that kind of got my mindset in place here. We'll hit a couple Twitter questions and see whatever else we want to talk about. So okay. Travis William asks, was Harbinger Renegade always planned to be a 9-issue series with a hiatus between arcs? Or was that a change of plans?
Yeah, I saw that question on Twitter. I was trying to figure out if I should answer that one. No, I had hoped and had plans for it to go longer. The sales numbers were not there, so we didn't get to do more. How about that?
That's, you know, the funniest thing is we already have answered that pretty much just like you did on the Valiant Central podcast when it was still going.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so Travis, you should just listen.
I wanted to go a little further, but I don't know. I think we saw the writing on the wall as we were getting close to the end there. I don't know. It's business.
Yeah, that's all you can kind of chalk it up to. I enjoyed the first arc of that series. Then kind of the second arc was different, also enjoyable, but drastically different. It was an odd feel, but it is what it is. All I can say is I'm reading your books still, and I'm not reading any Valiant books right now. So take that for what you may.
And I was another situation where became friends with the artist that I got to work with. It was a dream getting to work with Derek because I cut my teeth when I started really getting into self-publishing. I was on the Warren Ellis forum, and I probably talked about this on your old podcast about how I just really like Derek's work, and getting to work with him was a thrill, and still talk from time to time. Hopefully we get to work on something else again in the future.
Yeah, I've grown to appreciate his work more. I wasn't crazy about his art on Archer and Armstrong, but part of that might just be because I had a stronger affinity to Archer and Armstrong being the first title to draw me into Valiant. I didn't dislike his art, but I didn't love it. But seeing his work in other stuff has definitely opened me up to him quite a bit more. It just goes to show, like, you know, even if you don't love something, like, sometimes just because it's different, you got to adjust to it a little bit. But like his covers that he's done have been awesome. I've seen more variants he's done since the Valiant days of me, you know, reading his work. And
he did one for on Vault Comics, Wasted Space, which is like a parody of like a Crisis of Infinite Earths, which turned out really well. Super jealous of that one.
I was on one of the podcasts on our network, Best of the Rest, which kind of covers all the indie books that aren't covered by anything else. And we actually did the episode that I was on. We were talking about homage covers and kind of, you know, what place they take and stuff. And we talked a lot about how Vault is doing that quite a bit with their, I believe they're doing that with their reprints, if I'm right on that.
Yeah, it's usually like their second printings on stuff.
Yeah, we all agree that is a fantastic approach to doing reprints. That's, you know, just a whole new way to draw people in. So if you didn't get it the first time, it might catch you in it the second time. And if you did get it the first time, a good homage cover you're definitely going to grab.
Yeah.
Let's see. I didn't get a lot of questions, probably because I don't have a lot of followers on Twitter, and that's fine. Usually I get more questions than this, though. I think I just timed my asking for questions badly. Aaron Bell, who sold you those books, asks, why does he think no one can pronounce Ragnar Robots correctly?
Oh, there's a meme going around about, like, what's the worst thing about your name? And I complain that nobody can pronounce Rafer correctly the first try. And then he goes and tries to out-smart-ass the smart-ass.
He is definitely the most smart-ass person I know. And for him, it's not trying to be clever. For him, it's just a way of life more than an art form. So good job, Aaron. People have problems pronouncing Rafer.
Coffee mug that says professional smart-ass in it, and this guy's coming from my crown.
Sometimes the amateur smart-ass, they just put more heart into it.
That's true. They're hungrier.
He's working for that big pro smart-ass contract.
He's trying to get that first big break.
So people have problems with Rafer. I've always assumed Rafer was the correct pronunciation.
That's good, because you can read.
I am good at reading.
I'm getting salty here. Late night comics after dark. I'm sorry, that came out way snarkier than I intended.
Saltiness is totally fine. We're just bringing me back to my Valiant Central days. People pretty much thought I was an asshole because of Valiant Central, because that was, like, it's boring if you agree with everything. So whatever Martin said, I would just disagree and argue, even if I completely agreed with him. So I was always Paul's an asshole. So is it the Roberts that people had trouble with?
Yeah, well, I get that as my first name. Like, I'll go to, like, a doctor's office or something, like, what's your name? It's like, Rafer Roberts. And I'll be like, I can't find you here. It's like...
Well, you shouldn't pause in between. That's,
Robert? Like, that's my first name? Because it's not. Like, oh, yes. Yep. It's not my first time. I've had this name my whole life. I know the tricks.
Yeah. My
people would just come up and be like, so where's that name come from? It's like, I swear to God, I got to get those cards printed up where it just has the story and I can just give them a card.
Oh, God. My big burden is trying to spell my last name on the phone. Because there's a lot of S's. There's a lot of letters. The most clever response I ever get is, that's close to Tennessee. Like, it's close. It's not Tennessee. But S's sound like F on the phone. N's sound like M on the phone. It's impossible to spell my name on the phone. And I learned from my mom. My mom would always go, she would use, like, other words for the letters. So T-E-S-S, like Sam. So I do that. And I've learned that people, it just blows their minds when I do that. They're like, what the hell are you saying? There's not a Sam in your name.
Yeah, people are dumb.
That's what we're getting to the bottom to on this podcast. I think we're losing joy and happiness.
Everybody who's listening to this podcast is smart. It's everybody else who's dumb. I saved it. I pulled it back in.
Pulled it right back in. Good. You people are all great. Ooh, it's the rest of them.
Almost made everybody mad at me.
Yeah, digging around through Twitter for any other questions I have definitely doesn't do much to dispel the notion of dumb people.
I don't want to talk about Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw you retweet something that made me go, like, what the hell is going on in the world? But I want to bring that up. We don't need to talk about that.
Positivity here.
So let's get back to a little positivity. So Sparky's one of the most positive people I know. He jokingly threw out there, but I will throw this out there, that he would love to be drawn into modern fantasy. So it may be too late for this arc, but future arcs. He's a farmer with one arm, and on our podcast logo, we give him a robot arm. Do it with a robot arm, you know.
I'll talk to Kristen.
Throw that out there.
Farmer with a robot arm might fit better in Grumble, honestly.
Maybe both of us in Grumble. I'm pretty normal. I'm kind of boring. You can kill us. Like, we're both happy being killed, but...
Oh, I thought that was just assumed.
Yeah, it's pretty much always assumed. I was supposed to, so I became casual friends with J.K. Woodward, and he was supposed to put me into one of his Star Trek comics, but then he never did. So I still need to get killed by somebody one of these days. So Sparky asks, what's your favorite comic book character of all time?
Oh, God. Well, my brain, like, if this was like a Rorschach test, I would have just blurted out Ben Grimm. So I guess it's Ben Grimm.
There you go. You know, once again, back to the therapy. We're getting to the heart of the matter.
Yeah, I just try not to think about it. I don't know if that's true or not, but that just popped into my brain first.
Are you a big fan of Kirby? Are you a big fan of Jack Kirby?
Yeah,
obviously
I wasn't
everybody.
So much when I was a kid. Yeah. Like, I grew up reading all the early Fantastic Fours, and it's like, I don't like this early Kirby art so much because I like John Byrne. John Byrne was the gold standard for me when I was growing up. But as I got older, I really just learned to appreciate Kirby a lot more. And now, it's like my go-to. It's like, what do I feel like reading today? This or this Jack Kirby comic that I've read 100 times? Now I'm going to read that Jack Kirby comic I've read 100 times. So I just want to stare at it and learn more.
Yeah, it's like you go to Chinese food, you get orange chicken. Because you don't want to mess around. You want to get the thing you know you love, even if other stuff might be good. I think that's why we always go back to the things we love the most, rather than something that's a little more challenging sometimes.
Yeah, it's. I think there was a comedian or there was a meme or something about it. It's like a restaurant that you go to all the time, but you only ever get that one thing. So whenever anybody says, like, hey, do you want to go to Roy Rogers? Like, no, I don't want the rodeo burger, chicken burger thing. Today's like, you know, they have other food there. Like, ah, I don't care.
Yeah. I don't know what the other food's like. I know what this is like.
It's like, you want to go get Chinese? No, I don't feel like getting General Tso's today. Like, you could get something else. No. No. I don't know what I'm about.
I think that's what it's like going back to our favorite things. But Jack Kirby, so, you know, I don't have any real history with comics. So Jack Kirby's really something I'm slowly exposing myself to more. But one of the things I've been blessed with as a burgeoning comic fan is I've had 3 different really good comic shops. The first shop I went to was Coast City Comics that did the convention that I mentioned. And not only was Tristan, the owner, really awesome, but one of the guys that worked there all the time doesn't work there anymore, but he's actually into comics. He's doing a lot of stuff at conventions, and he's starting to do his own work. Jarrett, I'll tell you his group his last name if I don't look it up, so I'll do that while I'm talking. But they were great. And they exposed me to a lot of stuff. They were the ones that got me to Jarrett Melendez. There we go. They're the ones that got me to get Valiant. I went in there. They were having a sale the first day I went in there. My wife actually told me to go. My wife, who doesn't give a damn about comics, told me to go to a comic shop and spend money. So that shows you how great my wife is.
Nice.
So I go in there, and I'm like, I want to get something different, but I have no clue what. Right now I'm reading the X-Men and Batman. So they rambled through some stuff that didn't really catch my interest. Then they said everything Valiant's doing is good. And this is when Valiant was like still 4 titles into their launch, you know, very early. And so I said, I don't know what that is. So they showed me, and I picked out Archer and Armstrong and Bloodshot. And then it was also not long after the IDW Ninja Turtles series started. So I picked up all of that that they had. But they were just always great. They got me in a lot of different stuff. And the second shop I went to was a guy who actually convinced the owner of an old shop, Zimmy's Comics, that they've actually been drawn into comics and stuff like that. Like, they have some history. He got the guy to reopen. So he runs it. The other guy was just kind of the I guess you'd say, financial backer of the shop.
Right.
So, it, like, that was just a whole nother perspective on stuff. And, you know, the things that Dan, who ran the shop, was into was different than the other, you know, Tristan and Jared at Coast City. But now the shop I go to now, because I keep changing shops as I keep moving further north in Maine. But now we own a house, so I'm probably not moving again. But the shop that I go to now is Editor's Note in Hollowell. And Zach, who opened it up, like, he just opened it up because he was at the age, it's like, it's now or never. If I don't do this now, I'm never going to do it. So he did it. And he's a huge Ninja Turtle fan. So it's really cool having a shop where, like, the owner is a much bigger Ninja Turtle fan than I am. So I can actually go in there and learn interesting stuff from him on a regular basis. But he's just, like, he's really, really, like, his heart is in the comics. So he's, you know, more into anything than I'll ever be. But he, his dog's name is Kirby, you know, from Jack Kirby. So he's the one that's been kind of exposing me to Jack Kirby. That's a long-winded way to get about to that, but it's
I'll give you the 2001 series.
2001. Let me take a note of that.
Yeah, it's a very accurate adaptation of the movie. Have you seen the movie 2001?
I have at some point.
Okay. Yeah, you remember that part where there's like barbarians and aliens and Machine Man comes and starts screaming, "Who took my face?" Yeah. It's really good, and it'll never be reprinted. But it's probably my favorite of the, because there's just, it's like Kirby just doing whatever he wanted to do. It's like, all right, this issue's going to have this. It's like, this issue's going to have this. And I think by, it was issue 8, they go, "Jack, you got to put a plot in this thing." You're like, all right, here's Machine Man. And then it's canceled.
One of the cool things I got exposed to from the shop is Zach bought not original pages, but like proofs that were from Jack Kirby's estate. So he bought them straight from Jack Kirby's son, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, he's got like these packages he does online. Keep meaning to pick one of those up.
Yeah, so it's like all these pages of the proof. So it's just like essentially a big photocopy of an original art page, but with all the notes on it.
Yeah. But
it was also owned by Jack Kirby, so it kind of has that element to it. It's really cool. Like, it's just cool having a shop owner that is like so heart and soul into comics that you see these random things. Steve Levine, who worked on the early Ninja Turtle stuff, he had a shop down in Wells, Maine that he ended up closing up a few years ago. He had so much cool Ninja Turtle stuff in there, and he had
is
these.
Is that how you pronounce his last name? I just realized who you're talking about.
That's how I pronounce it. If it's not Steve Levine, I've been butchering it for a long time. But I've met him a few times, so I hope I'm saying it right.
I'm sure you're right.
I'll check with Zach. Zach will definitely know because he still works with him to an extent. But he has all these big Ninja Turtle statues in there, and Zach bought one of them. So he has a giant Leonardo in his very, very small comic shop. So that it's he also has an original page from did you check out when – did you Commandy Challenge. DC was just publishing like a new run of that with different creators, and Kevin Eastman did an issue of it.
Oh, yeah, the Tom King issue. That was
yeah, great. Tom King wrote it, great. And I'm going to screw up the name because I always flip-flop all these names. The artist that did Batman TMNT.
I don't know.
Freddie Williams either wrote it or was the artist. I'm going to screw the name up right now. But so in this issue of Commandy Challenge, Kevin Eastman did the artwork with this artist. Who I apologize to everybody listening that I'm totally botching the name right now. But it was really awesome because he has one of the original pages, and they did it on the pages that Eastman and Laird worked on the original Ninja Turtle stuff with. So they did the same technique, the duo shading and everything.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So it's really cool because it's Eastman working with this new artist who's fantastic, whose name I can't remember at all for some reason.
I don't even think they make that paper anymore.
Yeah, it's crap that he had lying around. So they're all getting cancer to make you Commandy Challenge. There you go, people.
Oh, Lord. Hey, I just looked at the time.
We've been going a while. Freddie Williams, that's who it was.
Yes.
James Tinian's the writer. See, I put their names together and made James Williams. All right, well, it's getting late. I'm sure you want to... Yeah.
Well, this was good. It was a good conversation. Went three times as long as I was expecting.
you're welcome to you know come join us again. By us I mean me because Sparky has bad internet. But you're welcome to come back anytime you want to chat about anything. I'll keep an eye out for when you're doing new stuff for sure. But if you need more therapy, I'm here for the therapy. That's my biggest goal is of course the mental wellness of comic creators. So that's what we're here for.
We need it.
So everybody can find you on Twitter at Plastic Farm. I know that much. Is there anywhere else that they should go looking for your stuff?
I'm Plastic Farm everywhere. Plasticfarm.com is my main website. Plastic Farm on Instagram. I think on Facebook it's Rafer.Roberts because it's Facebook and they have to do something different.
Boring.
Also, I would encourage people when they're going to their store to buy copies of Modern Fantasy to let them know that they also want to buy Grumble, because Grumble number 1 is in previews right now and is available for pre-order.
Awesome. I will be doing that as a matter of fact. I will probably actually send my shop owner a message on the Facebook in a moment, so don't forget, because I'm good at forgetting. But yeah, go check out Grumble, check out Modern Fantasy, both those going on by Ray for right now. You can also check out, I know it wasn't too long ago, that Valiant released a hardcover collection of your Archer and Armstrong work, which is very fun reading.
Oh, yeah, that turned out real good, too. They put some of the bootleg pages in the back.
Nice.
Very happy about.
Those bootlegs were awesome. That was a great idea.
Yeah, they put the first one in the back and the cover for the second. I imagine there's probably some potential for lawsuits if they had printed the second. That's all directly ripped off of Princess Bride.
I think I still haven't physically printed the second one. The first one, a friend sent to me, but the second one I got digitally, and then I sent it out to other people to spread it. But that was a great, just a great idea of a way to spread that, and something that was kind of exciting and different. I feel bad for everybody that has spent a fortune on eBay for that.
I don't. I've won. It's a full. It's like four pieces of folded over paper. Obviously, just I don't know why people are paying $50 for this thing. All right, I do feel a little bad because comics has perpetuated this collector mentality of scarcity. So you gotta buy the thing right now while it's at least a little bit affordable. But I wish they had asked me about it before they put down that money.
See, fortunately for me, I'm just always too broke to buy cool stuff. So, yeah, I don't have to worry about getting scammed on something that's not actually worth the value. But anyway, so that's where you find Rafer on Twitter. You find me on Twitter at Who's Paul. Find the podcast on Twitter at occasionally STW, excuse me. We're on the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Go to nerdylegion.com to check out our podcast and many other great podcasts. Sparky will be back with me eventually. We actually, he just released the last episode he and I recorded today, and he's busy with farming, so it may be a little bit. I actually have J.K. Woodward slated for my next guest, so we'll be talking to him soon. And I guess I'll have to find some way to offer him some therapy. Cool story about J.K. Woodward. I asked him about David Bowie music when David Bowie died, because I'd never listened to David Bowie. wasn't you know, really my thing. So I asked him what should I check out, because, you know, I wanted to know what the hell was going on, basically. And he just told me to get a pen and paper and call him. So I call him up, right, and he talks to me about David Bowie for like 20 minutes. But that just goes to show you comic creators are awesome. It's been awesome talking to you, Rafer. You're welcome back anytime.
Thanks. This was a blast.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all right.
maybe I won't rush next time. I'll take my time. So,
I'm so tired.
Thank you for joining us. Everybody, have a good night. All right. That's a wrap. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah. Thank you. That was fun.
It was fun.
All right. That's good. That's a good ending. Just us laughing and giggling at something that listeners did not hear.
Sparky will cut it at some point. He'll judge when. Right. That's why I sent it to him. He actually does a good job editing. Yeah. So.
Sparky, don't me. Cut out the part about me slapping.
He'll just it. That way people will be really confused as to what you're saying.
He was so good all episode, and then he just went on a 30-second swearing rant at the end.
Have you ever seen the necessary censorship thing? I think it was on the Jimmy Kimmel Show or something like that.
Yeah, it would be like that.
There you go, Sparky. You got a job.
Cool. All right. Well, I do have to run.
Thank you, Rafer. I will talk to you hopefully sometime in the future.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Cool.
All right. Catch you later.
All right.
Bye.
That wasn't terrible.
That was pathetic. Boo.
Nerdy Legion.
Nerdylegion.com.